From Salamis, distant across the blue of the gulf, it was just possible to make out a stub of rock framed against the sky. This tantalizing waymarker was the Acropolis of Corinth, the watchtower of the Peloponnese, and barely 5 miles south of the Isthmus Wall. Perhaps predictably, then, it was a Corinthian, the young and fiery commander, Adeimantus, who took the lead in the council of war that immediately followed the return of Themistocles to the allied fleet. "Leave for the Isthmus at once," he demanded of Eurybiades and his fellow admirals. "Concentrate naval and military resources together. Join with the army already massed along the Isthmus. There were bays and gulfs enough around Corinth to guard the flank of a battle line. And if disaster did overtake the fleet, well, at least the Peloponnesians might then find a refuge among their own people." Hardly, of course, an argument designed to thrill an admiral from Athens, nor those from Aegina and Megara. And it might have been thought, since these men were in command of around 3/4 of the Greek fleet's total of 310 triremes, that their objections would prove decisive. Not a bit of it. The risk facing Themistocles and his two colleagues was the same one that had haunted the war effort from the start, that the alliance might fragment and disintegrate. Outnumbered probably 2-1, as the Greek fleet still was, not even the Athenians could afford to go it alone. Any split among the allied squadrons would sink all hopes of victory. And it was victory that Themistocles was aiming for, not merely a holding operation, as was envisaged by Adeimantus, but a decisive crippling of the great king's whole naval capacity. To convince his colleagues that this ambition was more than just the fantasy of a desperate exile, he drew on the one thing that could unite them, and gloriously so: the joint memories of the Artemisium campaign. Themistocles knew that battle in open waters, which the Greeks would face if they made their stand off the Isthmus, favoured the enemy. But battle in close conditions, he urged, works to our advantage. This was the lesson he had drawn from the day of the fiercest fighting, when the allied squadrons, although battered, had successfully held the passageway between Euboea and the mainland against the full weight of the barbarian fleet. The straits in that battle had been some 2 or 3 miles across. At Salamis, if the barbarians could only be lured into them, the waters were 1/2 mile wide at most. "If everything goes well, and the prospects for that are not unreasonable, then we can win." And here, for all the soaring self-confidence with which it had been delivered, was a judgment quite as rooted in the experiences of everyone who had fought at Artemisium, the Peloponnesian admirals included, as in the fertility of the Athenians' ever-scheming brain. Themistocles himself well appreciated this, for he had, to a degree that none of his opposite numbers could remotely rival, made a career out of persuasion. Democracy, in its first decades, had proved an exacting school. No one in the world was now better practiced at getting his own way than a successful Athenian politician. The effectiveness of Themistocles' pitch can be gauged from the fact that, when midway through the Council of War, messengers arrived with the terrifying news that the barbarians had been seen entering Attica, setting fire to the whole country, the meeting did not break up in panic. Nor, despite the blood-curdling realization that the Persian fleet might be gliding into Athenian waters at any moment, and perhaps blocking off the escape routes, did the Peloponnesians press their demands for an immediate withdrawal. Instead, all of the high command agreed that the fleet would stay where it was, off Salamis. Themistocles, for the moment at any rate, had convinced the doubters. And this despite the fact that he was now, in the eyes of his fellow admirals, that most despised of all creatures, a man without a country. Such a label was not entirely accurate, of course, not while Salamis remained in Athenian hands. Nor, even with the Persian cavalry clattering fast towards the city, had Athens herself been wholly surrendered. One stronghold, the sacred heart of Attica, still held out. Not even the iconoclastic Themistocles had ever proposed that the Acropolis should be abandoned. Instead, by a vote of the assembly, it had been agreed that the treasurers and priestesses remain on it to guard the property of the gods.